first new numbers come out every day in the coronavirus pandemic, the numbers of cases, the death toll, the percentage of positive tests, and more. The overall death toll in the United States is approaching 85,000 today, which most public health experts say is probably an undercount. But our next guest is worried that the daily numbers are becoming background noise, and that in the effort to reopen the economy, we might be too willing to accept the daily death toll as a fact of life. Charlie Worzel is an at-large writer based in Montana for the New York Times. Charlie, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, do you see this happening, the idea that Americans are, in a way, growing numb to this daily death count caused by COVID-19?
Yeah, I think so. And I don't necessarily think, this is obviously a terrible notion and a very callous and cruel one, but to some degree, it's also understandable. I mean, we're not used to death at this kind of scale, and it's difficult when it happens across a large country like ours to contextualize it. It's hard to, if your town isn't experiencing a massive outbreak, if your hospitals aren't overrun, it's hard to understand and comprehend what 2,000 deaths a day looks like, or 1,800 or 1,500 or even 900. We've tried, I think, to try to direct some comparisons, the number of people who died throughout the conflict in Vietnam, the number of people who perished on 9/11, but none of those things are really adequate because it's happening over such a large, area and over this period of time. So I think that there's just some way that we almost, just as humans who have to adapt, we have to, we have to take care of our kids. We have to sort of move on, every day and live. And sometimes, you have to sort of numb yourself to that. So I think that there's a little bit of that happening because it's hard to process the scale of the devastation we're seeing.
But you're also worried in your piece that apart from becoming numb, we might also accept this death toll, I think, as a consequence of reopening and doing business. And you worry that may lead us to bad choices. How do you see that potentially working?
Yeah, I feel to some degree when you look at some of what's happening out there, when you look at some of the resistance to the stay-at-home orders and resistance to shutting down the economy, we're starting to see that these discussions are framed in terms of things like liberty and, my freedom to go out and make a living, and my freedom to go in public spaces or not to wear a mask, whatever you want to say, whatever you want to call it, and that we need to get back to some sense of normalcy because it's economically crippling. And sort of, virus be damned. And I think that is it's basically suggesting that there's some kind of acceptable price that we have to pay for this, in order to open our economy. We're actually going to have to just, with this virus still around, we're going to have to accept a certain number of deaths. And while no one will come out and say it quite harshly, it does seem like there is a move by some to want to accept this.
You make an analogy with firearm deaths, becoming background noise. We have this regular toll largely because of suicide and gun death. Can you compare and contrast those for us?
Yeah, absolutely. As a country, we are relatively numbed to that gun violence. There are bigger mass shootings that we are very aware of that make news and sort of engage the same debates over and over again. But the needle doesn't really move. And even when those terrible events happen, they don't shut down public life and public discourse in any way. They're just sort of, they've become part of the fabric of the American existence. 36,000 Americans are killed by guns. That's roughly, 100 per day, and most from suicide. And it has become in our national conversation almost an acceptable toll to some degree. It's politically not viable to pass effective gun control or gun safety legislation, including more stringent background checks and gun show loopholes, red flag laws, licensing systems, things like that. And so we have sort of resigned ourselves to the fact that, you know, this is part of the American experience. And I think that debate and that that stymieing of, you know, of gun safety laws is led by a small fringe group of gun rights advocates who are, you know, essentially they're not representative of the larger gun owning population, which is a group of people who are very responsible and who are who really take, gun ownership and the Second Amendment incredibly seriously. It's part of their culture and they do it in a very responsible way. And it's a really great show of what makes our freedoms great. But that is sort of perverted by a smaller group of people who frame it as any sort of measures towards safety, any measures towards a collective thinking towards driving down our national death toll is tyranny. And I think we're seeing a lot of that with the liberation protests. You know, those are small protests. Public opinion, as it is with gun safety, is actually well in favor of laws that will, protect people and also protect our rights. And that's the same with, I think, with this virus. But the fringe is really the group that is dictating the conversation, and that makes it very, very difficult to have a productive one.
Talking to Charlie Warzel, Montana-based writer for the New York Times, about a piece he wrote saying he's worried that we're becoming desensitized to the daily death toll of COVID-19. Reading your piece, Charlie, I thought of another cause of death here in the United States, drunk driving. And the Mothers Against Drunk Driving and other advocates did a good job of, I think, personalizing, like showing the individuals who are affected by drunk driving wrecks, and use that to bring attention to that issue. When you look at the media and our focus on numbers, do you think we should have more focus on the individual tragedies that go along with that?
I think that's a really great comparison, because they have done a great job. And I will say, I talked to a number of gun safety advocates, and they're also, they're very empathetic. They want to have a dialogue that preserves the rights of people while also acknowledging the pain there. And I think the same thing has been done with the drunk driving advocacy, where you have a very, you don't have people who are trying to, bring back a prohibition or something like that, but it's about, finding common ground. And part of doing that is to ground the story in human experiences. And I think that is some of the difficulty, I think, with COVID-19 and what we are seeing. It is not attacking communities uniformly. Even in some states, there are places that are heavily hit and others that are sort of that are spared, and it seems that there's no real rhyme or reason. And so if you're in a community that hasn't really experienced that, it's very easy, say if you live in New York City, to understand the stakes of this virus for young and healthy people and older and more vulnerable people alike. But if you live in an area that hasn't really seen this, it might not feel quite real to you. So I do think grounding the conversation around this virus in that same way, around real stories, around real showing and explaining what is at stake here, it will be a crucial way if we want to have some common ground in this debate.
We're talking to New York Times at-large opinion writer Charlie Warzel about people becoming desensitized to the COVID-19 death toll. You can join us at 800-642-1234. Is that a concern you have, that the numbers, the daily numbers, just become a background noise here in the United States? What are your thoughts on weighing the impact of the health consequences of COVID-19, the deaths that come from that, versus the need to keep an economy going? How do we balance these things out? Call in with your thoughts, your questions for our guest at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with at-large opinion writer Charlie Warzel with the New York Times. We're talking about people resigning themselves to the amount of sickness and death that comes with reopening the economy amidst the COVID-19 pandemic. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you see this happening? People becoming numb to the daily numbers coming out? What do you think about the trade-offs between shutdowns to help slow the spread of the virus versus the economic damage, the real economic damage that can come along with that? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Charlie, as we've mentioned, you are in Montana, not an epicenter. Same here in Wisconsin. We have had hot spots around the state. What do things look like from the vantage of Montana? What are people talking about there?
Yeah, we, very thankfully have been spared the worst, I think, of this outbreak. We are, today we reported zero cases in the state, as we have a couple of different days in the past few weeks. And we, as part of that, have been moving to open up, and we're sort of in almost the second phase of that now, where some restaurants are starting to open up and other places. I think that a lot of the reason for our good fortune has to do with our governor Steve Bullock acting very quickly, shutting down schools after the first case and well before the first death, and with stay-at-home order, very sort of get those cases down. But I think we exist in sort of it's an odd experience to be here, as I'm sure it is in Wisconsin, when you have sort of driven the caseload down, when it does feel like things are under control, there should be a move to open some things back up. Obviously, we can't retreat inside our homes forever. And so it's that balance of trying to figure out how best to do it. And I think there's still a lot of anxiety and concern, given that there's no vaccine, and there's not, there aren't therapeutics that are widely available and effective at the moment. There's still a lot of concern. I think there's so much we don't know about the virus. A popular restaurant in Missoula, the town that I live in, when it was clear that things were going to start opening back up, they pulled their patrons on Facebook and said, who would feel comfortable if we opened up coming back in to eat? And overwhelmingly, the reaction was, we don't feel comfortable. We love you guys, but I don't think we really want to sit down and eat. And so I think there's this very, difficult push and pull right now between wanting to open up the economy, knowing we should, and citizens maybe not being fully on board to participate in the economy.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Andrew joins us in Whitewater. Andrew, hi.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Andrew?
So I just wanted to kind of build off of the point about the restaurant. So I was a server, and I waited on tables, and throughout flu and cold season, we constantly come into contact with, utensils that people are putting in their mouths, napkins that they're wiping their mouths with, sometimes dirty Kleenexes, and really the only thing that you're able to do is, when you do have to handle that sort of stuff, you have to wash your hands after and be aware that, you are handling things that you could come into contact with somebody's, mucus and things like that, and you still go on about your job, and, we don't shut down for flu and cold season. And I just think you have to be aware of what's going on and take precautions like regular hand wash.
Andrew, thanks a lot for the call. I think that's a common comparison people have made. COVID-19 has been way more dangerous than cold, certainly, and more dangerous than most any flu season on top of the actual flu season. But weighing that risk that Andrew might have dealt with as a server, Andrew, on the job, that's something a lot of people are doing.
Yeah, I think it's also, you know, it's a really difficult situation to put people in, I think, especially people in the situation of being servers. I mean, this is your livelihood. Everyone should be entitled to a living wage and to be out there working if they want. And yet, you know, it is, there's still so much we're finding out about this virus, about how it affects people, which, you know, which pre-existing conditions, things like, you know, asthma or smoking or what have you, you know, put you at greater risk. I think we're still trying to figure those very basic things out. And that's difficult for people to hear. And I really understand the, you know, the idea of letting people take risk, make their own assessments there. But you know, the one thing that I will say is I think if we are moving towards reopening, we do have to have some guidelines that aren't as strict for those people who want to take more risks, and sort of giving people a, you know, a set of metrics, maybe assigning point values to different risky behaviors and saying, you know, here's how many points you can tally up before you're really, really putting yourself and others at risk. I think we're going to have to find ways to adapt to this new normal.
Thanks a lot for calling in, Andrew, at 800-642-1234. Talking to Charlie Worzel, at-large opinion writer for The New York Times, looking at the death toll, the impact of COVID-19, and he's concerned, he writes in a recent piece, that we may become numb to the daily figures. Charlie, what I've heard from some public health experts and others is an attempt to change a mindset from, am I personally at risk if I catch this disease? For many young, healthy people, the answer is probably not. And they want to change the framework to, am I at risk of passing this disease on to other people in my life, in my social network, who might be vulnerable to this illness? Can you talk about that mindset idea?
Yeah, I think it's incredibly important. I think that, you know, one way to look at these lockdowns, which I think has been really helpful, is that as the compliance with them has largely been, you know, uniform. And to some degree, they are kind of a profound political act. It is a group of people making a poignant personal sacrifice for others, for the help of, you know, to make sure that your, you know, the people who you sit next to in church don't get sick, to make sure that your coworkers don't get sick, to the people who you serve at the restaurant or the people who serve you at a restaurant don't get sick. And I think we need to think about it that way, as you said. I also think that, you know, one thing that makes this so difficult is that there is so much asymptomatic spread of this virus, and there is such a little amount of time before you know, the onset of symptoms, and being, you have to catch it at just the right time, and that in order to do that, we need a very effective system of testing and tracing and contact tracing involved. And part of the reason that people are advocating to keep the lockdowns going in states where there are outbreaks is that system isn't in place yet. I don't think there's anyone who, if we had a national robust testing system and tracing capabilities, anyone who you know, wants this lockdown to continue. It's people wanting this to continue to protect each other and to make sure that, you know, that as many people stay healthy as possible.
Is there, Charlie, you think, an element of the frog in the hot water in all of this? If I'd told you, I don't know, 8 months ago, hey, next year there's going to be this disaster, it's going to kill 85,000 people in less than 2.5 months, that would have sounded really horrible. But because we've had this steady buildup and this ongoing thing in the midst of it, it doesn't feel as shocking somehow.
I think so. And I think a lot of this is, you know, we're living through this crisis in real time. There's not other than, you know, the 1918 flu, there's not really a precedent for this in most of our lives. So we're living through something that not a lot of people can, you know, have any experiences to draw from. So that makes it really difficult. I do think there is some of that, you know, we become, again, numb to the situation. The first couple of weeks of the lockdown and the virus are terrifying. And, you know, the more we learn about it, the more we get comfortable with the decisions that we might have to make. But also, it's just simply that we can only be shocked, and we can only be cowering in fear for so long. Our bodies actually, you know, force us to adapt. We're very adaptable beings, and that's a real strength. But in some cases, it can make us act perhaps a little more quickly than we need to. But I think the big issue that I worry about right now is around messaging. That you know, we've told people to stay inside, to flatten the curve, and framed that almost like it was the end game. But flattening the curve has never been the end game. If you listen to epidemiologists and public health officials, flattening the curve is keeping our hospitals from becoming overrun, buying us time to build up testing and tracing, and to discover cures and therapeutics. So we have a new sort of we have a new phase that we have to go into, and that is where we adapt to this and try to get as much normalcy as we can while keeping people safe. And I think there's a lot of people who feel like the goalposts have been moved, that, you know, they thought if they flattened the curve and stayed inside for 2 months, they'd be done. But it turns out we're not. And I understand people who are frustrated with that, and I sympathize greatly with them, because this is awful. And it's really, really, it's really difficult. I mean, this is a profoundly tumultuous time in our country's history, and we have to, you know, live through it.
Charlie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Charlie Worzel, at-large opinion writer for the New York Times. We talked to him today about the risk of people becoming desensitized to the rising death toll from COVID-19.